Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of subjects and issues in the news. We'll begin with an update on the Egyptian elections and speak with Sama Shahata, a professor of Arab politics at Georgetown University's Center for Contemporary Arab Studies. He is just back from Egypt, and we will discuss the incomplete revolution that may be further reversed by the election of a president who represents the old guard. Then, as many countries expel Syrian diplomats in protest, we will speak with Asher Kaufman, who is a professor of history and peace studies at the University of Notre Dame. He has an article at CNN, "Only Russia and China Can Stop Carnage in Syria," and we will discuss whether international outrage over the Assad's latest massacre of women and children will sway Russia and China to rethink their protection of the Assad regime at the UN Security Council and their support of the Annan plan that is being so flagrantly violated. Then finally, we'll speak with Chuck Collins, the author of 99 to 1, How Wealth Inequality is Wrecking the World and What We Can Do About It. We'll discuss whether the almost unlimited financial resources and support from the mainstream media that the candidate of the 1%, Mitt Romney, has can be matched by grassroots mobilizations and an awakened moral outrage amongst the 99%, many of whom want jobs and justice, not a so-called job creator. Joining us now is Sama Shahata, who's a professor of Arab politics at Georgetown University's Center for Contemporary Arab Studies. He's the author of Shop Floor Culture and Politics in Egypt, and his most recent book is Islamist Politics in the Middle East, Movements and Change. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sama Shahata.
Thank you for having me.
And you're just back from Egypt, where you observed the elections. I spoke with a sociologist who did his own kind of informal research, field work, if you will, on the 2 days. And there was, a considerable amount of elation in general, even though the results are somewhat disappointing in as much as they're quite polarized.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think there was a kind of a roller coaster of emotions that people were experiencing. The excitement of the campaign ahead of time and not knowing the outcome, which is very unusual for Egyptian elections under Mubarak. The joy that the elections went off on the both days of voting relatively well without any kind of violence or electoral fraud, the ability of Egyptians to actually participate in the democratic process. And then, of course, the anxiety afterwards, waiting for the outcome, and then the concern and continuing anxiety about the specific outcome with these two polarizing individuals facing each other in a runoff next month, Mohamed Morsi, the head of the Freedom and Justice Party of the Muslim Brotherhood, and, of course, Ahmed Shafiq, Mr. Mubarak's last prime minister and longtime regime official and ally.
So what happened to the left? Why they got 40% of the vote, but the vote was split?
Yes, I think that certainly the two other candidates of the five serious ones, Hamdin Sabahi, a populist Arab nationalist candidate, and a moderate liberal Islamist, Abdelmunim Abdel-Fattah, could be considered different degrees of the left. And they did quite well. But as you mentioned, their voting was split. And they ended up together maybe getting about a little less than 40% of the vote. And of course, they did represent different trends. I mean, Abdelmunim Abdel-Fattah was a longtime member of the Muslim Brotherhood, certainly the more progressive part of the group, whereas Hamdin Sabahi was an old Arab nationalist, you could say quite liberal in one sense.
But my understanding is that he was the most representative candidate of those who propelled the revolution in the first place and who in many ways feel betrayed and sidelined.
Well, it's true that of the candidates that had a serious chance of winning and received large numbers of votes, he was the one who was closest to the revolution and the revolutionary principles. There was another candidate of the 13 on the ballot named Khaled Ali, a 41-year-old, very active labor lawyer who has a history of defending workers and Egyptian farmers, who really was a revolutionary and was, in some senses, closest to the revolutionary elements who were in Tahrir from January the 25th until February 11th. He received a very small percentage of the votes, but certainly Hamdin Sabahi and also the other moderate Islamist, I think, represented some of the more general aspirations of the revolution.
Again, I'm speaking with Sama Shahad, who's a professor of Arab politics at Georgetown University Center for Contemporary Arab Studies, the author of Shop Floor Culture and Politics in Egypt, and his most recent book is Islamist Politics in the Middle East, Movements and Change, and he is just back from Egypt where he observed the elections. One of the stories that came out, and I'm surprised that it hasn't got much play here in the press in the United States, is the extent to which the Saudi Arabians and to a lesser extent the Gulf were trying to buy the elections. Apparently, they actively participated in trying to buy the parliamentary elections, which resulted in the Salafists coming out of nowhere and coming in second. And apparently, they were just pouring unlimited amounts of money in to affect the elections. I'm surprised that that hasn't sort of gotten more press, because I find it quite alarming that a country would try and essentially go against Egyptian, the trajectory of Egyptian democracy, and try and create some kind of feudal theocracy.
Or support some elements as opposed to others. I mean, I think it needs to, two things need to be mentioned. You're completely correct that there's a widespread belief that Gulf money, particularly from Saudi Arabia, was pouring into Egypt after the revolution to support some elements as opposed to others. There's, of course, very little empirical documentation of it, but that's difficult to do. But there's a widespread feeling that that was the case, even, I think, among some U.S. officials. And then, of course, the logic to understand it is, you know, Egypt is the most populous country in the Arab world. It's quite close to Saudi Arabia. Only the Red Sea separates it. There are 2 million Egyptian workers in Saudi Arabia. The Saudis follow Egyptian television, Egyptian politics. And I think many in the Saudi regime are quite concerned that the democratic winds coming from Tunisia and Egypt could blow across the Red Sea, and that, of course, causes them a great deal of alarm. There's no question that Saudi Arabia supported the Mubarak regime up until the end and is no friend to democracy in the Arab world.
So let's turn to the results Sama Shahada, with these polarized results with the Freedom and Justice Party, the Islamist candidate Mohamed Morsi, and General Shafiq, Air Force General. His headquarters have already been sacked. He's considered, at least those who sacked the headquarters, referred to him as the Falul, the Arabic word for the remnants of the Mubarak regime. You know, the military never went away, did it? I mean, its fingerprints have been over this revolution, I mean, from the beginning, in the sense that they were considered in many ways the heroes of the revolution because they didn't shoot the people in Tahrir Square. But it's pretty clear that they don't necessarily support them either, right?
Well, I think it's very clear, should have been clear from the very beginning, that they didn't represent or support the principles of the revolution. And I think it's questionable why they didn't shoot the revolutionaries. It could have been simply that something like that wouldn't have worked, or the command wouldn't have been followed at the lower levels of authority, and so on. It's clear, of course, also that there was only one moment in which the military's interests and the interests of the millions of people protesting against the Mubarak regime overlapped, and that was to derail Mr. Mubarak's inheritance plan to pass power on to his son and so on. However, after that finished, I think one could see clearly that the interests of the military, and particularly the military council running the country, and Egyptians' aspirations for genuine democracy, including civilian control of the military, not to mention end of corruption and so on, diverged. And of course, the military council has incredibly mismanaged and botched, with both malice and incompetence, the transition, quote-unquote, period from February 11th until the present. There have been well over 150 Egyptians, protesters, who have been killed by the needless use of excessive force against them by the authorities since that time, over a number of incidents and so on, Christians and Muslims in Cairo and elsewhere, not to mention the thousands who have been brought up in front of military trials and so on.
So the Islamist candidate is in the runoff against the remnant of the Mubarak regime, Mr. Shafiq, who promises stability. And on the other hand, the Muslim Brotherhood candidate, Mohamed Morsi, is trying to suggest that he represents pluralism. And he says that he's not going to treat the presidency like the Superman, that it's a one-man show, that he wants to make it more inclusive. The real issue, though, surely is, isn't it the day after? Whoever takes over, don't they have to tackle some daunting economic problems with youth unemployment, about 4 million young, 70% of whom are between the ages of 15 and 29 are out of work?
Yes, there's no question that it is not an enviable position to be the president of Egypt when the dust settles. As you mentioned, the economic problems have not only not disappeared, they've gotten worse. Tourism is down. It's a major source of revenue and a major employer. Egypt's foreign reserves have dwindled to half what they were when Mr. Mubarak stepped down. There's virtually no foreign direct investment. Egyptian investors are also quite nervous about the situation in the future, and they haven't been investing their money in the country. So those kinds of issues, the continuing strikes and labor unrest, the demands for deepening the revolution, and so on, all of these things aren't going to go away, and whoever becomes president will have a very, very difficult time, I think, meeting the raised expectations and the deteriorated economic situation that faces them.
And how would a future leader, either Morsi or Shafiq, deal with the bloated and inefficient public sector, which clearly needs restructuring, but on the other hand, in doing so, you'd create more unemployment?
Well, that's correct. And there have already been 600,000 or 700,000 new government jobs that have been created since the revolution by the parliament in a kind of populist, appease the population manner. Well, we know about the economic platform of Mohamed Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood, which is very pro-market, encouraging small and medium enterprise, open to foreign direct investment, and so on. And we would assume that Mr. Shafiq's economic policies would be largely a continuation of the Mubarak-era economic policies, which is also one of kind of neoliberal economic reform, quote-unquote, and so on, but with a heavy dose of cronyism and nepotism and corruption. So that's, I think, what the economic policies of both of the candidates would be in short.
So in terms of the spirit of the revolution, is there any way that that can be revived and that those people who brought about it can ever feel that they've been anything but marginalized?
Well, you know, right now there's talk of course, continuing with the protests. There was a protest in Cairo and so on. And I think it's without doubt that especially if Mr. Shafiq wins or is declared the winner of the elections, there will be immediate protests in Cairo and other cities objecting to the idea of a former regime, Mubarak regime official, holding the presidency. Not only will there be protests, there's likely to be violence as well. And I think that there already has been massive change in Egypt, having to do with political freedoms and activity and so on. It's just a question of deepening that change and institutionalizing it. So the revolution is not over, it's not completed, and it needs to continue regardless of whether Mr. Morsi wins or General Shafiq wins.
If General Shafiq wins and does so by fair means, not foul, that would indicate, though, that a lot of Egyptians want stability. Isn't that what his appeal is?
Well, that's certainly correct. And the public opinion polling data that the Gallup organization has done recently indicates that the primary issue that most Egyptians feel is important right now is security followed by the economy. And, of course, that has to do with the deteriorated security situation in Egypt. There's been an increase in crime and lawlessness. The perception of insecurity is far greater than the actual increase in insecurity. And then, of course, there's the economic situation that we've mentioned. Of course, 20% of Egyptians live below poverty and another 20% live close to the poverty line. And their situation has gotten worse since the revolution. And many of those who voted for Shafiq see in him a pre-revolution economy and a pre-revolution security situation. Now, I think that's false for all different kinds of reasons, but nevertheless, that's what they see in him, and that's part of those who voted for him, in addition to former regime elements and regime supporters, and a very large number of Christian voters who see in him a secular state or the antithesis to the Muslim Brotherhood.
But is he, Shafiq, both the fireman and the arsonist, in as much as that apparently the Mubarak regime had up to a million, I think, thugs on the payroll that kept the peace, if you will?
Oh, yes. I think it's a false security. I mean, the Ministry of Interior employed over 1.2 million people in uniform and out of uniform. And the kind of security that Mr. Shafiq wants to bring back with an iron hand isn't a security that any kind of democratic society would tolerate. It would come at the expense of freedom and liberty and democracy and progress in terms of the revolutionary principles. And in fact, I don't think you would even be able to achieve it for the reasons that I've mentioned. He is the antithesis of the revolution, regardless of how he spins himself, and he will mobilize people to take to the streets to protest and attempt a second revolution. And he said he would meet that after winning elections with an iron fist, because he would be the legitimate president, and that means more violence and more instability. So I think Shafiq's promises would be unfulfilled.
So in terms of, and of course Shafiq and his army cronies or military cronies have a big chunk of industry, don't they? Is there any way that, I imagine that's kind of, shall we say, pretty inefficient, right? It's not exactly a free market situation. Is there any way that the grip that the military has over the economy can be loosened?
Well, I think it's going to have to be loosened in the medium and long term. Certainly, a Shafiq presidency is going to delay that or even put it off completely. I think a Morsi presidency or any non-military presidency will begin to shed some light on that. Hopefully there will be some transparency. There will be kind of a limiting of the role, the economic role of the military. But I think that's also going to take some time. I don't think any candidate of the ones that had a serious shot of winning expect to have a head-on confrontation with the military, because that's would be difficult, it would cause more conflict, it might not be winnable in the short term, and so on. But I think there's no question that in the medium and the long term, military economic activities are going to have to shrink, there's going to have to be light shed on them, and there's going to eventually have to be civilian control of the military, which of course is necessary for a democracy.
Well, just in closing, in terms of foreign policy, how do you think that's going to pan out? Obviously, the Israeli government and the Israeli people, I think, are quite nervous about, polls indicate, I think, about 50-50 of the Egyptian population support continuing the Camp David Accords. But clearly, it's creating a lot of uncertainty, particularly in Israel.
Yes. Well, in the short term, there will be no change whatsoever. All of the different groups have maintained their adherence to Egypt's previous commitments and international treaties. And the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty is going to continue. What there is wide agreement on in Egypt is that the specifics of the treaty are going to need to be modified, having to do with the placement of Egyptian armed forces in different parts of Sinai. Certainly, I think that any representative government in Egypt that comes to power, either under Mr. Morsi or anyone else, is going to pursue a different Egyptian foreign policy than under the Mubarak regime. It's going to be much more sympathetic to Palestinian demands. It's going to be less hostile to Hamas and possibly other Islamist movements. I think eventually there's going to be a softening of the Egyptian-Iranian confrontation. Egypt doesn't have full diplomatic relations with Iran and so on. And I think Egypt is likely to move further out of the orbit of the United States. I don't think it's going to be a dramatic or immediate change, and I don't think it, as I said, threatens the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty or American-Egyptian relations in the short term.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Sameh Shahata.
You're welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with Sami Shahada, who is Professor of Arab Politics at Georgetown University Center for Contemporary Arab Studies. He's the author of Shop Floor Culture and Politics in Egypt, and his most recent book is Islamist Politics in the Middle East, Movements and Change. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about what could stop the killing in Syria. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Asher Kaufman, who is a professor of history and peace studies at the University of Notre Dame. Prior to that, he taught at Hebrew University and from 2000 to 2004 was a research fellow at the Harry S. Truman Research Institute for the Advancement of Peace and headed its Middle East unit from 2004 to 2005. Asher Kaufman is the author of Reviving Phoenicia, A Search for Identity in Lebanon, A History of Modern Lebanese National Identity, and his forthcoming book is Contested Frontiers, Cartography, Sovereignty, and Conflict in the Syria-Lebanon-Israel Tri-Border Region. He has an article at CNN, Only Russia and China Can Stop Carnage in Syria. Welcome to Background Briefing, Asher Kaufman.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And clearly the, I don't know that it is a turning point, but some people are saying now this massacre in Houla is a turning point, not as if Assad or the Assad clan have not been murdering civilians now for over a year. Do you think it's a turning point?
Well, time will tell. We don't know yet. There are some moves in the diplomatic arena. European countries have expelled the Syrian ambassadors from their capital, so we will see. I think the big issue, as I've said in my article, as I've written in my article, the big issue is how Russia and China would respond to this new challenge.
Well, Russia has already changed its position a little, has it not, by joining in the UN Security Council's condemnation?
Yes, this is true. Yeah, despite the fact that that condemnation did not really point any finger to any of the sides, and I think it reflected Russia's pressure to draft this resolution in a way that the Assad regime would not be blamed for the massacre.
Well, Russia, of course, has instigated the so-called Annan peace plan, and it's pretty clear that this massacre is a gross violation of the peace plan. Do you know how the Russians are rationalizing this?
As far as the Russians are concerned, they've stated it publicly. The two sides are committing gross violations of human rights, and therefore the regime should not be singled out in the critique, but rather the opposition should face the same critique. And the solution for the problem in Syria is not removing this regime or Bashar al-Assad, but actually working with Bashar al-Assad towards some political change. But it is very difficult for me to see how that would be possible. Because right now, this may have been possible a year and a half ago. It is definitely not possible right now. The opposition, and rightly so, would like to have an entire overhaul of the political system. That cannot take place while this regime is still in place. So the Annan plan, despite the fact that it has good intentions, indeed it is the only place, it is the only plan, a political plan, out on the table right now, but I cannot see it evolving positively towards the resolution, because The bottom line is that as things have deteriorated in Syria in the last year and a half, I don't see any possibility for a resolution that will incorporate the regime as it is today with its power structure in Syria and have any kind of political resolution that would put an end to the violence.
Well, Asher Kaufman, this regime has been in power for almost 50 years, and it has employed these tactics before with the massacre in Hama, where they shelled a city and killed up to 20,000, the estimates are, civilians. And it's maintained its hold through ubiquitous secret police and these independent militias, the Shahiba militias, and now it's been at war with its own people for a year and a half. It's just ratcheted up methods already in place. It believes, surely, that this is their own private plantation, if you will, the Assad family, and they're going to kill people, and that's been the MO, to kill people to keep them in line, either intimidate them or kill them. But I've not seen any evidence that they've ever wanted to compromise, wanted to have any real reform. So why are we kidding ourselves?
Actually, we are not. I mean, if you observe the events as they have been unfolding, and if you are not a politician or a diplomat, then you clearly see the situation as you have just described. But diplomats and politicians have different agendas, and they have to play a different game to what they are seeing, and therefore what you see in the UN is a sort of a diplomatic game that all parties are being involved in, despite the fact that I think most observers would be able to tell you that it probably would not lead to anything constructive, positive. As you've said, the Assad regime has been in stronghold of the country over 40 years, and right now it's fighting for its own survival. It's even physical survival, survival of Assad and his family, and it's political survival of the entire political system. And when you fight for one's survival, then you do certain things that we can see now happening in Syria.
Tell me about, though, what's your explanation for the apparent paralysis? And I suppose in many ways it's fair to describe the position of Israel and the United States in this vis-a-vis Syria as one of ambivalence, because my understanding is that nobody's seriously arming the rebels. Maybe the Qataris and the Saudis are, but not on any scale that would ever match the Syrian military. It seems as if the United States is leery of what might follow Assad, assuming that it's not a protracted civil war. And it equally seems that Israel is kind of ambivalent about the idea of the Muslim Brotherhood coming into power. What's your understanding of both the U.S. and Israel's position?
I mean, I think Israel should be singled out from the American position here, because no matter what Israel does now with regards to Syria, it would be a problem for Israel. And no decent Syrian opposition person would accept aid from Israel. That would be basically a
kiss of death.
Kiss of death to any opposition force in Syria. So Israel should really, I think Israel leaders understand that, and there is a great anxiety in Israel about as to what would come out of this civil war that has been evolving in Syria, because Israel, all in all, has been comfortable, convenient for Israel to have the Assad regime. I mean, the Golan Heights have been the most quiet front line of Israel since the 1973 war, and who knows what would happen if Assad falls. As for the United States, there are domestic issues here in the U.S. that I'm sure the Obama administration is grappling with. And there is no appetite for another front in the Middle East. Upcoming elections clearly play a very important role in the decisions about what to do in Syria. And I think if the United States opens another front in the Middle East, in Syria, that would have repercussions on the elections, and Obama definitely is not interested in that. So what is left to do is more political pressure, diplomatic pressure, maybe tightening the sanctions, pressuring other U.S. allies to exert more pressure. But nobody is talking about, you know, a military intervention here.
Well, what is Mitt Romney talking about then when he said yesterday that the President Obama's lack of leadership has resulted in a policy of paralysis that has watched Assad slaughter 10,000 individuals?
He is thinking about the presidential seat that he would like to sit on in the next year. I mean, this is what is in his mind. I think that any president, American president, with a survival instinct today would not, political survival instinct, I mean, would not send American troops to Syria now. I mean, this would be a big mistake, again, from domestic political considerations in the United States. And Romney is trying to push Obama, obviously, to demonstrate that he would be a better leader in that respect. And that, again, is part of the political maneuvers that take place in any political context that is completely separate from what is happening, you know, on the ground in reality.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Asher Kaufman, Professor of History and Peace Studies at the University of Notre Dame. It's a little puzzling, though, in the sense that I've seen videotape of a lot of the Free Syrian Army and the opposition people and some of the rappers that have had these songs that have been viral on the internet against the Assad regime. And one of the refrains often is that Assad, you know, you've sold us out. As you mentioned, the Golan Heights have been quiet between Israel and Syria, and that Israel's had a very workable relationship with Syria. A lot of the Muslim Brotherhood, the Syrian opposition, accuse Assad of having sold out to Israel and being, in effect, in complicity with Israel. So that surely bodes for a change of attitude if the Brotherhood replace the Assad regime.
Well, I mean, whoever would replace the Assad regime, they'll have to take into consideration Syria's interests. And I don't think Syria's interests would change much with a different regime. I think Syria would still want to get the Golan Heights back. Syria would still have interests in Lebanon. I mean, Syria has been involved in Lebanese politics before Assad came to power, before Hafez al-Assad came to power. And that would stay, I think, after Assad falls, if and when. So whoever comes to replace this regime would still have to deal with the unfinished business of Israel holding the Golan Heights. And if it would be the Muslim Brotherhood or any other political organization, political figures, this is what they would like to get, what they would want to get from Israel, getting back the Golan Heights. And that will not change. As far as the Muslim Brotherhood's critique of Assad, you know, this is a very famous, this is a very familiar critique that the Assad family, Hafez and Bashar, his son now, have basically let Israel keep the Golan Heights because they understand that, you know, in the power dynamics, asymmetric type power dynamics between Israel and Syria, they cannot really get the Golan Heights by force. So they used Lebanon for decades as a way to put pressure on Israel, knowing that a direct confrontation in Israel is impossible in the power dynamics or the power structure between Israel and Syria today.
So is there some differences then between the U.S. policy, not that it's easy to figure out what the U.S. policy is, and the Israeli policy? Because just looking at it in a cursory way, you would think that since Israel and particularly the Netanyahu government have made it abundantly clear that they consider Iran and the Iranian regime an existential threat to the state of Israel, and that they and Netanyahu seems to be spending most of his time talking about the dangers of Iran and the dangers of Iran with a nuclear weapon and threatening some kind of preemptive strike. So there's no mystery about that. So how come Israel is not helping undermine this regime in Syria that's the only foreign policy asset, along with Hezbollah, that the Iranians have? I mean, I don't get it.
I mean, as I said, I mean, there are, I would say, two reasons, one tactical and the other political. The political is very clear that for the opposition to succeed, they should distance themselves from Israel.
This is, yeah, I think that's very abundantly clear. Yeah,
this is very clear. Practically, I mean, you could think about Israeli shipments of arms to the Syrian opposition, but I cannot see it really happening. There is a higher likelihood that it would come from Europe, or that it would be at least implicitly supported by the United States, but the arms would not come from Israel. So the best thing for Israel, and I think this is what the Israeli government is doing right now, is just watch, observe, and wait for the outcome. And nobody really knows what the outcome would be. It is simply impossible to know.
So in terms of then people that are actually doing something in support of the Syrian opposition, then it's basically only Qatar and the Gulf and Saudi Arabia, and it's difficult to see exactly what they're doing. Turkey's clearly giving sanctuary to some degree. I would think that the border that's open for smuggling through would be the Jordanian border. I don't know the extent of what Jordan's involved. What's your understanding of who is actually helping the Syrian opposition?
Well, the Syrian opposition has strong support in Lebanon, and indeed arms are being smuggled from Lebanon to Syria. This has been now the place, the route of smuggling, which is an interesting historical anecdote, because for decades the smuggling routes were the exact reverse. Arms were smuggled from Syria to Lebanon, and now this is the reverse direction. Money comes probably from some of the Gulf states, and this is for the most part how the Syrian opposition today arms itself. It is possible that it also happens through the Turkish border, maybe the Iraqi border. I am not sure about that, but I know for a fact that it does happen through Lebanon. And it is not a match to the military capabilities of the Syrian army. They are better equipped, and therefore they perform better in this. Perform, of course, it's a difficult word to use, but they simply do better in this armed struggle against the opposition.
Well, but they not only are the opposition completely outmatched militarily. It seems that the actual killing is done by the militia that they form, the Shabiba, the ghosts. I believe the word is in Arabic,
yes.
And that these are hired thugs, prison guards, etc. A lot of them are paid bounties, and they were apparently the ones that did the actual slaughtering in Hula.
Yes, these are the reports that are coming out, that the majority of the killing actually were done by these armed militias. And, I mean, this is another demonstration of the fact that we have, what we are witnessing is a civil war.
But it's not a civil war between two sets of tribes or population. It's a civil war between a military and their allied thugs and a civilian population. It's an asymmetrical civil war. I mean, is there a better term for it?
This is true, but if you look at who are most of the fighters on the pro-government side, then you would clearly see that most of them are Alawites. And most of the opposition, not all of it, are Sunnis. And it's slowly but surely becoming a civil war that is characterized by these sectarian divisions.
Mm-hmm. Well, just in closing, just to return back to your article at CNN, Asher Kaufman, only Russia and China can stop carnage in Syria. So far, they haven't. Russia seems to be sending somewhat mixed signals. Apparently, Putin has ordered an arms ship that's been shipping arms, been unloading arms in Syria to go back to sea. It's difficult to know whether Putin responds to public opinion. I believe that Russian public opinion is in many ways against what's happening in Syria. At least amongst the kind of people that don't follow the regime propaganda. I don't know how much they count. And China seems to be maintaining its position. So when you say in your article only Russia and China can stop the carnage in Syria, what do you think it's going to take for them to act?
I think further pressure from the international community. I mean, in part, this European concerted effort by expelling the Syrian ambassadors, I think it is directed to Russia and China as much as it is directed towards the Assad regime, because I'm hoping that time would come and both the Russian and Chinese leadership will understand that I mean, there is so much pressure on them internationally that they must take a stand, and that this stand cannot be this, you know, impartiality that seemingly they have held so far, where they didn't actually put the blame on any side, but spoke about a resolution that would, in fact, would leave Bashar al-Assad in power. So my hope that would be that enough pressure would be exerted on them that they would simply lift their support from Assad, and I think that could be the tipping point that you mentioned at the beginning of our interview.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Asher Kaufman.
Thank you for this interview.
Again, I've been speaking with Asher Kaufman, who's a professor of history and peace studies at the University of Notre Dame. Prior to that, he taught at Hebrew University, and from 2000 to 2004, he was a research fellow at the Harry S. Truman Research Institute for the Advancement of Peace and headed its Middle East unit from 2004 to 2005. He's the author of Reviving Phoenicia, The Search for Identity in Lebanon, A History of Modern Lebanese National Identity, and his forthcoming book is Contested Frontiers, Cartography, Sovereignty, and Conflict at the Syria-Lebanon-Israel tri-border region. He has an article at CNN, Only Russia and China Can Stop Carnage in Syria. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back in a moment. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Chuck Collins, a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies and director of IPS's program on inequality and the common good. He's the co-author of several books, including Economic Apartheid in America, a primer on economic inequality and security, The Moral Measures of the Economy, and Wealth and Our Commonwealth, which he co-wrote with Bill Gates Sr. He's the co-founder of Wealth for the Common Good, a network of business leaders, high-income households, and partners working together to promote shared prosperity and fair taxation. His latest book just out is 99 to 1, How Wealth Inequality is Wrecking the World and What We Can Do About It. Welcome to Background Briefing, Chuck Collins.
Thank you, Ian. Great to be with you.
And your book, 99 to 1, How Wealth Inequality is Wrecking the World and What We Can Do About It, it's certainly wrecking the world. But here at home, the disparity in wealth is growing. And I am wondering why it is that America's capitalists, except for the few that you work with, are so callous. In many ways, they've blamed globalism on the downsizing of America. But I think, in all fairness, so much of the problems that we have in terms of the distribution of wealth in this country is simply that the elite are greedy and they don't really care sufficiently about their fellow Americans.
Yeah, I think that what we're seeing is a segment of that 1% that is very content to rig the rules in their favor, to rig the rules of the economy, tilt them in their favor, and then talk about these inequalities as if there's some kind of disparity based on deservedness and effort. And it's just a very cruel hoax, really. And it has nothing to do with individual effort and differences in that regard. It really is about how the rules of the economy have been rigged in a way that hurts some people and benefits others.
Well, also, they have created this myth, which the candidate of the 1%, if you will, Mitt Romney, is propagating, and he's going to obviously be beating the drum on this for the next 6 months, that the wealthy, who somehow or other shouldn't pay taxes anywhere near equal to what we have to pay, in fact, they pay less than half on carried interest, etc., which is what Mitt Romney's been playing, less than 15%. The average household pays 35%, the people who actually work for a living. This canard of the job creator is so pervasive, and thank God for this fellow, Nick Hanauer, who did the talk for TED, which they didn't want to release, and I guess they were shamed into releasing it. What was your response to Nick Hanauer's talk?
Well, it was marvelous, you know, and he is like a lot of our wealth for the common good people. He understands that wealth is a function not just of the individual effort. I mean, it has something to do with that, but it has a lot to do with the society. The commonwealth, the institutions that that we build together that make individual wealth creation possible. And so, again, that the part of the myth or the hoax is, hey, these inequalities are a reflection of individual effort. Some people work hard and smart, and some people don't, and that's why we have inequality in America, as opposed to some people may have used their wealth and power to rig the rules of the game to get more wealth and power. That's the real story. And that's why Nick Hanauer and Bill Gates Sr. and some of our Wealth for the Common Good members, when they get up and say, you know what, I've been the beneficiary of a wonderful society that's made wonderful public investments that enable all of us to have a great opportunity, and I have an obligation to pay back the society that made it possible. That's why I should pay more taxes, and that's why a message like Nick Hanauer's is so important.
But in terms of job creation, Hanauer absolutely eviscerates the Paul Ryan and Mitt Romney propaganda of the job creator by pointing out that capitalists, the last thing they want to do is hire people. They only do hire people when they have to, and the reason they have to is because of popular demand for their product. And what he's saying is that it's not the billionaires who are the job creators in this country, it's a vibrant middle class with money in their pockets so that they can create demand and buy the products of these very short-sighted capitalists who don't seem to get the big picture.
You know, that's the fascinating thing, is that you hear people talking about, oh, the job creators, help the job creators, right? And that's why we should cut taxes for the wealthy. But then if you actually talk to the wealthy individuals who are job creators, they'll say, you know, taxes are not that important. What really matters is, you know, having customers with money in their pockets. What really matters is a healthy infrastructure of public investments that make the economy work well. It's not like people are sort of saying, oh, I want to pay a lot more taxes, but they're saying we have to pay some taxes, and if you're very wealthy and fortunate, then you should pay a lot of taxes, you know. And in the book 99 to 1, I make a distinction between the companies that are built to last, businesses that are in it for the long term, and companies that are built to loot, whose whole business model is about laying off workers, shedding jobs, getting other people to pay their taxes, getting other people to carry their load. And that's you know, the built-to-loop companies are the ones that we should be defending ourselves against in this current economy.
Well, Chuck Collins, your new book, of course, 99 to 1, How Wealth Inequality is Wrecking the World and What We Can Do About It. Give us a sense of what you're hoping to achieve with this book. Obviously, there is a tremendous asymmetry between people like you who are trying to get the message out and the enormous power of the media establishment. And clearly, we're going into an election year, and because the media has this sort of binary notion that there are two sides to everything, there's going to be a tremendous amount of investment into allowing Mitt Romney to appear as a credible candidate, even though, you know, in many ways he seems to be running on the notion that he's going to be the new CEO of America. The long and the short of it is that he'll be getting his message out. He's got billions of dollars behind him through super PACs. How do we get your message out and Nick Hanau's message out?
Well, I think that we are, I think that the 99 to 1 lens or theme is very powerful. And we should be using that to make the contrast, you know, that there's policies that help Main Street, there's policies that help Wall Street. There are policies that help the 1%, there's policies that help everyone else lift the whole society, have an economy that works for everybody.
Prior to this election, of course, there'll be a kind of referendum in Wisconsin, and there again, the 1% are pouring money in. This woman that was caught on videotape telling Governor Scott Walker there that she wants him to make the state a right-to-work state, and she's put up half a million dollars at least to defend his recall. So that's kind of a precursor. And then you'll have the big election where billions will be spent by both sides. What's the formula, though, for the guerrilla movement on the side of the 99%, the ones who don't have super PACs?
Well, you know, starting now and into the fall, we should at every opportunity point out to anyone who's willing to listen that the 1% is trying to, you know, has captured our democracy and is trying to use their money to further cement their power and control. And we should be offended by the, that a couple hundred multimillionaires and billionaires are hijacking our democracy, buying attack ads, subjecting all of us to kind of a vile politics. So I think it's a really good opportunity to point out, hey, look at when this is what happens when the 1% has, you know, almost 40% of all the wealth of the nation and 23% of all the nation's income, and they use their wealth to expand their wealth. This is what it looks like. This is what a plutocracy looks like and feels like. And that should be offensive to all of us, and we should use it as a chance to push back and you know, pass ordinances like the Move to Amend ordinance to repeal the Citizens United decision and just clamp down on money and promote policies that like taxing the wealthy, taxing the 1%, that will actually reduce these extreme inequalities.
But just in terms of your book, Chuck Collins, the book is really a handbook in many ways to get motivated, to get informed, and to get activated. The chapters are, coming apart at the middle, who is the 1%? How the 1% rigs the rules of the economy, a life of the 99%, the Wall Street inequality machine, how inequality wrecks everything we care about, how wealth inequality crashed the economy, the sleeping 99% giant wakes up, reversing the inequality death spiral, bold rule change to break up concentrated wealth, and the conclusion, prospects for greater equality. That just gives you just a sort of general idea. But, I mean, I take it you're trying to both educate and activate, right?
Absolutely. And I'm actually one of those people who thinks we can reverse these conditions. Yes, I know we're up against huge, powerful forces and wealthy individuals who have whole media empires at their disposal. But, there is a huge awakening happening in the land. People are, the polls are showing. People are like, see how these inequalities are damaging everybody's prospects for having a good life. that there's an awakening within the 1%. There are actually these allies stepping forward, the patriotic millionaires and Wealth for the Common Good and others, that the 1%, that the Wall Street juggernaut doesn't hold all the cards. And that if we organize and push forward policies, we can transform our country just as we did 90 years ago. The first Gilded Age, 1910, 1912, you can think 100 years ago, we probably in the United States were as discouraged as ever about the possibilities for democracy. And yet social movements emerged, and the rural populace and the urban labor movement, the women's movement, other movements in the 20s and 30s really pushed to change the rules of the economy. And in the end, it had a powerful effect. So it's totally, we kind of know what the laws need to be changed. We know what the drift of public policy is, and it's really just a matter of kind of creating an organizing, campaign and joining up with efforts to change this. So I'm hopeful that we can reverse these extreme inequalities.
So just in closing, though, do you think that there is a way to make this a moral movement? After all, it was moral movements that brought about some of the great change in the United States, getting rid of slavery, for example. On the religious right, you have the prosperity gospel. You've got these preachers, these televangelists like Osteen, who are saying God doesn't want you to be a whiner, God wants you to be a winner. And they're essentially agents of the plutocrats in suggesting that somehow we can all win the lottery and that there's a level playing field. Meanwhile, of course, he's taking a lot of money from working people who can ill afford to give it. Is there, do you think, a possibility of tying what you're trying to do into a broader moral movement?
Oh, I think it's already happening. And if you, within the religious congregations and communities, I'm actually here in Manchester, New Hampshire, speaking at a religious congregation tonight. This conversation is in a whole different place than it was 2 years ago. People understand these extreme inequalities are a moral issue. The fact that there are all these young people who feel trapped with tens of thousands of dollars in debt, that there's millions of Americans who see no pathway out of poverty, that the middle class dream and ideal has collapsed and imploded for many people. Congregations, those are the people sitting in the pews. They're not whining. They just want to have a fair economy where the rules aren't stacked against them. And so I think that moral voice is part of this emerging movement, the 99-to-1 movement, and the We Are the 99% movement. All of those things will have huge positive impacts. So it's, the Occupy movement unleashed a moral story about what's happened in the last 30, 40 years in our country and how to reverse it. So I think that's the way forward for sure.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Chuck Collins.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Chuck Collins, who's a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies and director of Institute for Policy Studies Program on Inequality and the Common Good. He's a co-author of several books, including Economic Apartheid in America, A Primer on Economic Inequality and Insecurity, The Moral Measure of the Economy, and Wealth and Our Commonwealth, which he co-wrote with Bill Gates Sr. He's the co-founder of Wealth for the Common Good, a network of business leaders, high-income households, and partners working together to promote shared prosperity and fair taxation. And his latest book just out is 99-to-1, How Wealth Inequality is Wrecking the World and What We Can Do About It. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Chris Scheid. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.